Hey, what's up? This is Christian with the Most High Show. And today, again, we're using technology to our advantage. And we're talking all the way to my home state, California, connecting many miles apart through recovery and through the desire to help others and to share our strength and hope with other people. And so today we have the blessing and the benefit of talking to Greg Champion from StartupRecovery.com. And we're going to talk about his journey in recovery and where he's at now, and how did he get there. So stay tuned. This is The Most High Show.
Welcome to The Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and the 12 steps. Produced, hosted, and posted by people in recovery who've been given strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is The Most High Show.
Cool. That's my little intro.
I like it.
It's almost like I know what I'm doing, almost.
Yeah, you're there. You know what you're doing. That's good.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's great to meet you virtually, and this is one of the great benefits of this doing this podcast and creating this content is you get to meet really interesting people doing interesting things. So, Greg, can you tell me a little bit about what your life is like now in a life of recovery?
Yeah, so you know, my mantra is recovery first. And if I don't have my recovery first, then everything else I value falls to the wayside. And that would be my family.
Yeah.
That would be my children. That would be my business, my friendships, my health, but all fall to the wayside. And right. It used to be sobriety first, you know, and over time, having almost logged 25 years in sobriety, it's been recovery, Christian. And what I mean by that is, so my recovery looks like this. I get up very early in the morning at 5. I go to the gym because my mind is racing already. My alcoholic addict mind is racing. And after the gym, I have a nice coffee. I settle in. I do prayer and meditation. Something that changed for me was about 5 years ago, I began meditating first, then praying. I know in the 11th step, it says prayer and meditation, but for me to work that early morning ritual, it became meditation first and then prayer. I attend 4 meetings a week. Most of them are men's stags. I'm a big believer that men get men sober. I do go to 1 mixed meeting a week here in Los Angeles. And, you know, I really try to be of service when the phone rings, whether it's for fun and for free or for my business. I make sure I ring the dinner bell and I show up. There's an old saying here, we suit up and we show up. I try to suit up and show up for my friends, for my colleagues like you when you ask me to come on your show. Obviously my family. And that's kind of – and I also do it one day at a time.
Right.
I can really tell you that I have true peace of mind because I don't regret the past. I don't go way back in the past. And I certainly probably only get one day ahead of myself in terms of planning. Where in early recovery, I was always regretting the past. Oh, I gotta hop back in the DeLorean, you know, and go back in time, you know?
Yeah.
Or I'm future tripping, you know? And really, I the past is done and here maybe one day ahead. But that old cliche, one day at a time, is really how I run my recovery these days.
Yeah, I love it. I love that with this many 24 hours in a row that you're still doing the things that got you here. And yeah, that's really key. Still getting to meetings and still doing all the things that got you here. But you also mentioned earlier that you've supplemented and added some things in your recovery to enhance it and to keep you going further, because I've noticed, you know, that for myself, you know, at about a little over 8 years now, like very few days over 8 years, you know, I do see that there are certain issues that come up for me that weren't coming up my first 2-3 years, right? And so it's important that I have other people to bounce things off of. So personally, I have other, you know, counseling. I've used faith, church, I use everything that I can. So can you tell me what are some of the other things that you've used that help you stay in a mindset of recovery?
Okay. So for me, what I've garnered over time is three wise men and three wise women. Mm. These are people with long-term sobriety, long-term success, and long-term marriages. And all three of those are very important to me. So when I have a business question that might take me out emotionally, you know, away from my sobriety, I go to these three men and I say, hey, here's my problem. And I try to gauge what they would do. If I have an issue with my wife or my daughters or a female in my life, I go to these three wise women. And so that's been a great tool, almost like a board of directors.
Yeah. You know?
And I encourage everybody, yeah, go get your sponsor, but go get a board of directors. I've also taken on breath work. About 6 years ago, a guy named John Paul Crimi, out here in the West Coast, started a little breath work workshop. And he's grown it to a big, big business. But I was one of his first six students. And it's breathing into the belly, the chest, and out for about 25 minutes straight. Mm. And I do that every Monday night here in Venice. I do acupuncture. I do sound bath. I read a lot. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of recovery books from Eckhart Tolle to Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning to the Four Agreements. Mm-hmm. And those have been essential, those reading, the reading. So really for me, three things I can tell you is that the board of directors, mm-hmm. the wellness, self-care stuff.
Yeah.
And then also the last part is reading. Reading about recovery have been three things that I've garnered over the last decade in my recovery.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, the Four Agreements has been very helpful for me as well. I really like that book. And that's awesome. What is a sound bath?
Okay, a sound bath is, so you lay down on a yoga mat, right? You put a little eye patch over your eyes. And then this woman, her name is Susie Sheffian, her business is called the Copper Vessel. And I'm giving you all this stuff because I want your audience to have resources to go chase these people down.
Yeah.
And what she does, she has these 6-7 bowls in front of them. And as she plays them, it goes, makes all these different sounds. And that vibration comes over your body and your ears pick it up. And I got to be honest with you, I go to Mars.
Yeah.
I'm on Mars. Wow. I'm on Mars in 20 minutes.
Wow. And
so it's very California, you know, as we talked before. We have California stuff going on.
Yeah.
But it works. And here's the God honest truth about my recovery, Christian, is people ask me, how do you have almost 25 years? I've remained willing to be willing.
Mm.
I've remained willing to be willing. So when someone says, hey, you want to try and sound bath? Hey, I'm willing to try it. And once I try it and see that it works, then it becomes part of my playbook. It becomes a tool I put in my toolkit. So, but it's sound bath is blowing up. Breath work is blowing up. It allows for a natural high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and the thing I love about that is we're connecting the physical with the spiritual and the psychological, and it's all coming together, which I do think the 12 steps is a practical means to living out a spiritual life. And so that's what it sounds like you're doing. But it wasn't always this way, right? It wasn't always sound baths and deep meditations and helping others. So tell me, when was it that you or alcohol or drugs became a solution in your life?
Yeah. You know, what's funny. I love that you said alcohol and drugs is a solution. Mm-hmm. So many people think, oh, that guy's got a problem with drugs and alcohol. No, he's got a solution for drugs and alcohol. You know, I would say that, you know, I discovered drugs and alcohol around 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. I always think it's the perfect storm. I think, you know, you're a freshman in high school. It's available, right? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're going through puberty, which means the opposite sex is saying, hey, come and get me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so those three things are the Bermuda Triangle that gets you going in terms of checking out. And for me, I had some childhood trauma. I had my father was killed in a drunk car crash when I was 4 and a half. Mm. So I was raised by a single mother, so I felt different. automatically. And before I had access to drugs and alcohol, violence was my drug. I was a bully. I was a mean kid. I was in detention all the time. I was a talker in class. Because I felt different, you needed to hear me. And then that violence went away once I discovered booze, pot, and cocaine between the ages of 13 and 15. And that was pretty steady throughout high school. Not much damage there. I ended up going away to college. I picked a strong university for my alcoholism. It's known as Arizona State University, which was at the time the number one party school in Playboy magazine.
Wow.
You know, and I wanted to be amongst my people, you know. Yeah, I figured, right. I'm going to go to a party school where I know there's worse alcoholics than me.
Yeah.
So I was able to hide there for 4 years. Actually, I'm telling a lie. I was there for 5 years. And then what's crazy, Christian, is that, you go get this college degree and they tell you, hey, now you're out in the real world. And so on my first night, I got my degree. I got my first DUI.
Wow.
And from age 22 to 24, I proceeded to get arrested seven other times for various charges. Driving without a license, another DUI, a fight in a bar, pissing in the streets, fighting in the streets. Drug charges. And each time I got arrested, a couple of things were in common. One, drugs and alcohol were always involved.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Right.
And so the last two times I got busted was I had met some lower companions. I was working an overnight job at a TV station. And I got out at 3 a.m. Now, Christian, what kind of friends do we have at 3 a.m.? Right?
Right.
Yeah. These are friends you can't bring home to mom, right? You can't bring home to your wife.
Yeah.
And I found them and they found me and they suggested that we go into business together. And so I went into the cannabis entrepreneurship business in the early 90s. And did fairly well for a while. And until I got busted with 50 pounds of pot. I got busted with 50 pounds of pot. And the judge, I'm standing in front of the judge and he says, "You're a good kid. You went to Catholic private school. You've got a college degree. You grew up in a nice neighborhood in San Diego. What happened?" And I know you have these same three words. I said, "I don't know."
Right.
Because under the influence of drugs and alcohol, I don't know.
Right.
And so each time I went and did a drug deal, I had to get higher and drunker and stoned, more stoned each time.
Yeah.
And so what the judge did say to me, he says, "Listen, here's what I do know. If I see you in my courtroom in the next 6 months, I'm going to give you the 5 years of prison hanging over your head." 18 days later, Christian, I'm in my little sports car. I've drinking 6 moose head. I've had 2 joints, and I have a couple bindles of coke in my pocket, and I'm going to the party of the year. And I get to the party of the year, and I'm all alone because here's why: my high school friends have said goodbye to me. My college friends have said goodbye to me because I'm a lowlife. I'm an animal. And I walk in the party, and 10 minutes into this party, a guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, do you have any bumps on you?" "Oh, I'm a people pleaser. I have no idea who the hell you are, but I'll give you some bumps." And so we go back down the stairs, out the door, and into my car, and I pull out my Duran Duran CD case. You know, don't judge me on the music, Christian, you know. and you know, the back of the day, the CD case is all scraped up and all marked up, right? And I put out 2 lines, right? And I put it out in front of him, and he puts out San Diego Police Department.
Wow. Yeah.
And so what happened was the next morning I wake up in the jail cell, and this is really when you're asking, you know, no more sound bath, no more all this kind of, you know, foo-foo stuff. How'd you get recovery? How'd you get sobriety? Here's what happened. I woke up in a jail cell, fetal position, defeated. And it's about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I hear a voice in the corner and it says, "There's an easier way."
It's all right. We can edit that. So we're not live, so we can always go back and edit that.
So I'll say this. So I'm in the fetal position. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. And in the corner of the room, a voice says to me, Greg, there's a better way. Mm. And I'm like, what? Greg, there's a better way. And so I do listen, and it says, call your mother. Now, Christian, the last person I want to call is my mother. When facing 5 years in prison, I do not want to be calling my mother. Mm-hmm. Do you remember calling your mother on these kind of phone calls?
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I do. I call her, and here's what she tells me. Gregory? And she used to say Gregory, because our mothers always use the full name, right? Gregory, I want you to go to church. Mm. You want me to go to church?
Right.
Yeah, I want you to go to church. And so I went that night at 6 p.m. to a Catholic Mass. And the priest gets done with Mass, and he says, hey, we have confession after the Mass. Would you like to go to confession? If so, I have 6 priests, 3 on this side and 3 on this side. Just go into one of the confessionals. I think to myself, great, I'm going to go into confession, and I'll get my sins out, and that way I can go out tonight.
Wow.
Yeah. That way I can go out tonight. And so I go into the confessional. It's not like The Godfather where they have the screen up.
Right.
It's just like you and me. It's 2 men looking right at each other, probably 2 to 4 feet away from each other.
Yeah.
This priest is in a white cloak, white hair, ice blue eyes, and he says, son, tell me your sins. Mm. And I begin to tell him my sins. I say, hey, when I smoke a lot of pot, I show up on Christmas Day on the December 27th. When I do a lot of cocaine, I date 3 women and they have no idea I'm dating all 3 of them.
Mm-hmm.
When I drink a lot of booze, I get real mean and angry and I get bar fights.
Mm.
And when I do all 3, I take large amounts of marijuana across this country. And he stops me and he says, hey, do you see something going on with you and your sins? I said, what? He goes, do you think you have a problem with drugs and alcohol? And I said, no. I said, no.
Right.
They said, and Olson, for the very first time, I did what we call the AA pause.
Yeah.
And I go, you know what's funny? I said, you're the second man in my life to say something like that, to point the finger at me at what could be possibly a problem with drugs and alcohol. And he goes, who was the first? I said, it was my stepfather. This guy who my mom remarried and who was a World War II vet. Who was a self-made man who taught me how to shave my face and tie a tie and open a door for a lady, that greatest generation. He also fought on the beaches on D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part of this man, Christian, was he brought 17 years of AA sobriety into the house.
Wow.
So I was exposed to his birthday cakes, the chips, all that kind of stuff as a kid.
Yeah.
Right? And so the priest says, well, what was his name? And I said, Walt Janicki. The priest reaches across, grabs my hand, and says, wow, I was Walt Janicki's first sponsor.
Whoa. Wow. Wow.
And so right there, it finally hit me.
Yeah.
Okay, I hear you, God. Because it all starts with God. It all starts with God.
Yeah.
It all starts with God. I hear you, God.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, Christian, was I said to myself, whatever this man tells me to do next, I have to do.
Yeah.
And here's what he says. He says, look, your sins don't belong here. They belong 4 blocks up at the Alano Club, and there happens to be a meeting starting at 7:30, and I think you should go.
Wow.
And so I went. I went. And I went to my very first AA meeting. And then this priest, before I left, gave me a piece of paper with his name and number on it. He says, I want you to come to my office tomorrow. We're going to talk. And so the next morning I woke up and I opened a piece of paper and his name is Father Bill Wilson.
Whoa.
The same name as our founder of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Wow.
And I go, okay, I keep hearing you. You know, I keep hearing you.
Yeah.
And I remember my mom said, go to church. And what my mom was saying is go to God,
mm-hmm.
go to God.
Yeah.
And so, so I went and saw Father Bill and this is my root of my recovery. He says, I want you to do 3 things. I want you to stop using drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, that's good. So does the judge. And he's like, I want you to take boxing lessons.
Mm.
And I said, boxing lessons? And he goes, yeah, because when you do the first 2, you're going to have so much resentment and anger, you got to put it somewhere.
Yeah.
So I'm a big proponent of physicality in early sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
And then before I left his office, he says, what's your biggest fear? And I said, Father Bill, here's my biggest fear. I'm facing 5 years in prison. I don't want to go to jail anymore. I'm done. And he says, let me give you a math problem. Greg plus drugs and alcohol equals jail, right? That has been the proven fact 8 times in 2 years. Mm-hmm. He's like, take drugs and alcohol out of that equation, and I promise you, you will never go back to jail. And so nearly 25 years of sobriety, Christian, how many times have I been to jail?
None. Zero. Wow.
So I always tell people, hey, take drugs and alcohol out of the equation, and whatever your jail is, a bad marriage, financial problems, problems with the law, whatever it is, that jail will cease to exist.
Mm. Wow.
That's how I got to this program.
Wow. So you didn't go into any kind of recovery or sober thing? You
buck in the basket. I'm a buck in the basket kind of guy.
Wow. And how many tries did it take? Was it just the one try?
Yeah, the one try.
Yeah. Wow.
Because here's one.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The God thing. I thought to myself, with that God shot in the confessional, if I ever went out, it'd be slapping God in the face.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I get that totally. I mean, I felt like that too. Like there was a, I felt like, you know, I had a pretty soft, you know, ending to my drug and alcohol career. And I felt like that, you know, there was a protection or sense to me, and it's my own thinking, you know, that, and I felt like, man, if I go back, then whatever grace I was given, I'm kind of, you know, kicking it to the curb. And as many times as I was riding dirty and never got caught, and as many times I was put myself in situations where I could be, you know, murdered or mugged or whatever, that grace I felt like would be gone at that time, like to not return. But I also was ready. You know, I was tired and sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I was done. So that's, you know, I think ultimately why I didn't get back out there. That's amazing. That's powerful. What a powerful story, and what a powerful illustration of, you know, that this priest here, you know, and just the connection, man. That's amazing. Amazing. And yeah, great motivation to get into it and start working it. So you follow the suggestions, you go through the steps, you get a sponsor, you go to the meetings, you do what they say, and you experience the relief and the promises that they say you'll get, essentially.
So, you know, in that story, I really had step one, step two, and step three all happen for me.
Yeah.
But where I had to start doing the work was step four and five.
Yeah.
I truly believe, and I know from my own experiences, that if men and women can get through step four and five, 90% of them will probably make it all the way. They will remain sober, because I call it unpacking the backpack of shame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's childhood trauma, some sort of pain, shame, guilt, all that's there. And like you said earlier, we use drugs and alcohol as a solution to cover up that pain, to cover up that trauma. Mm-hmm. And so now that we have drugs and alcohol out of the equation, we got to go dig that pain and that shame out. And that happens in steps four and five, six and seven, and eight and nine. And really, I was really scared of step four. And I'll be honest with you, it took me 4 years to get to it.
Wow.
It took me 4 years. I just could not open that closet, that Pandora's box.
Yeah.
But once I did, I was set free. I was set free.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's amazing how it works. And what's interesting about guilt and shame is it's not always in the forefront. You know, like for me, it's in the behind the scenes pulling strings, and it's three layers or three thoughts deep is this shame that's really controlling my actions and my thinking and my dysfunction. And even in recovery, you know, it's like still for me personally is, you know, a few years in is realizing I needed to go back and do another fourth and fifth step, you know, that I'd held on to some things that I was going to take to the grave, and that's what they were doing. They were secretly creating dysfunction and discord in my home life and in my work life and my thought life. And it was because of that guilt and shame that I was never felt like I could really be myself. So I'm like, you know, in this, I'm like the man behind the curtain, you know, pulling all these levers and trying to hold it all together and never going back out. but also, you know, it was somebody read the promises and said, and I was listening to them and I thought, man, I don't have very many of those. You know, I'm still sober, but I don't have many of these promises and I want those. And what's wrong? What's going on? And being pointed back to say, hey, maybe it's time to do another fourth and fifth, and having the humility to being forced to the humility to say, okay, I got to do it. Right. Cause everything in me was like, well, I've done this before. I've done the work. Why do I have to go back and do this? And just taking a humble approach to, you know what? I have to be honest. I didn't address it.
Can you give me a specific example of something that you discovered that second or third time around?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it was, sexual stuff.
Yeah.
That's what you know? And that was the thing that it was like, I'm going to just carry this to the grave, you know?
Yeah.
And, there's so much around sex as an identity and who we are, and it gets so deeply rooted. And I know it's such a huge part of our, for those of us who are addicts, it's one of the things that can lead us back out, probably one of the top things that can lead us back out. And not dealing with that and reconciling that fully was what was creating a lot of drama in my life, and the guilt and the shame of it. So setting myself free from that, you know, it has been huge, you know?
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
So tell me, you know, you've gone through this, you've been working this program, you decide to do this startup recovery, this transformational house. Mm-hmm. You know, how long have you been doing that? And what was it that made you feel like you needed to participate in that way?
Well, Christian, I'm a big proponent of God shots. I truly believe that God shots have happened for me when I was drunk and high. God mm-hmm. shots have happened certainly for me in my sobriety and recovery. And so 4 years ago, I'm speaking from the podium and I'm talking about getting sober in my 20s. I'm talking about building a successful business where I mentor a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the gift of being able to teach entrepreneurship at USC out here in California. I talk about how I sponsor people. And this woman comes up to me after the meeting and she says, hey, based upon your experience, I think you'd make a great group facilitator at my rehab.
Mm.
And I grab my phone and I look in the Google and I type in group facilitator. I have no idea what a group facilitator is.
Right.
This is 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know? And she says, yeah, you basically come in, you run a class or a group. And so all of a sudden I began doing classes or groups at this one rehab up here in Malibu. And it was around entrepreneurship. It was around shifting addiction to passion. Mm. It was around writing and music and arts and really trying to get people, because here's what I feel is like, we get sober, the fog lifts, right? And now what? Now what are you doing?
Right.
So a big proponent for me is career, passion, vocation, legacy. And so I began running groups once a week. And then the owner comes to me and goes, hey, can you do two groups? And before you know it, I was doing six groups at one facility,
mm-hmm.
three groups at another facility. I still had my full-time job in marketing and PR. And lo and behold, a year into that, a friend of mine says, hey, you're doing all these groups. You should open up your own coaching business, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to my mentor and I said, hey, I'm going to open up a private coaching business around recovery. And this particular coaching business is going to be for people who are stuck. Hey, I just got to a year of sobriety. I'm stuck. I'm on year five. I'm stuck.
Right.
I'm on year 10. I'm stuck. And so I began taking on private clients, doing group facilitation still. And then I needed to name the company. Mm. And so I went to my mentor at USC. His name is Professor Patrick Henry. And I said, Professor Henry, I have this great possible business. I'm going to grow out here in Southern California. I need a name for it. And he says, Champion, here's what I know about you. Mm-hmm. You know recovery and you know startups. And all of a sudden he goes like this, Startup Recovery. And that's how we came up with the name.
Yeah.
And then I was doing coaching for a year. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years ago, a sponsee of mine came up to me and suggested, hey, I want to help you build out your business. And his name is Jeffrey Van. He is the co-founder of Startup Recovery. He's not only a sponsee, he's a dear friend, and he's my business partner. We just love each other, have a mutual respect for each other. And what our goal was to create a legacy around recovery and disrupt the industry in a way that would create shifting addiction to passion. And so what we did is we opened up our first home in December of 2017, mm-hmm. here in the Palisades. And what we did is we had four principles: accountability, community, education, and love.
Yeah.
And so as we brought new residents in, they would get those four cornerstones in each day of their recovery. Now, what we do here differently than most sober livings is, yeah, we provide meals and we find a nice place to stay, but we also bring in recovery coaching. Mm-hmm. And I do the coaching personally. And the recovery coaching starts recovery first. We got to get you a sponsor, got to get you a home group, got to get you some breath work, acupuncture, some sort of wellness part of it, get you through the steps.
Yeah.
The second part is career. Mm-hmm. We start coaching you on career. Do you want to push the reset button in your career? Do you want to go back to school and get your MBA? Do you want to move from New York to LA and start a new business? The third part is passion.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, when you were a little boy, did you play guitar?
Right. Well,
guess what? I'm going to put a guitar in your hand. You're going to start playing again.
Right.
For me, some of my passions are skateboarding, body surfing, and mint chocolate chip milkshakes.
Mm-hmm.
All three that I do on a weekly basis. And then the last part is legacy. And I'll ask you this, Christian. Mm-hmm. You're going to be on this planet for 85 years.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Right? You happy with 85 years?
I'd be good with that.
So in your 85 years, what is the most important day in your life?
Interesting. I don't know. I'm sure you have an answer for me.
I do. Here's what people do say. My sobriety date. The date my children were born. The date I got married. The date I got my law degree. Whatever it is. Right. Here's my answer.
Yeah.
It's the day they put you in the ground.
Yeah, definitely.
If someone's going to grab a podium... Mm-hmm. And saying, Christian did this.
Right.
What do you want this to be?
Yeah.
And that's the legacy piece.
Yeah.
You know? And so for me and Jeff, our legacy is to create this brand, Startup Recovery,
mm-hmm.
where people can come, get well, find recovery, restore their lives, put their families back together. And then hopefully we do this for decades. And then when we're long gone, these people who put their lives together have kids and grandkids.
Yeah.
Because we were able to help them. That's right. Our legacy.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of us live life like we're not going to die. Right.
Yeah.
There's a song, I can't remember the name of the band, but one of the lyrics is, you know, the worst word is afterlife. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to get too metaphysical, but the concept that, you know, that we're not going to die, or that there is some sort of finality to death, and whatever that means, whatever someone's faith is, and you know, but that we're going to die a physical death. Everyone's going to get that, and to maintain that, and that's great. I mean, because that's one of the reasons why we do what we're doing here, you know, and doing this podcast, and all the drama and the stuff that goes around trying to put things together and trying to get people like you on and recording it and make sure everything records and then getting it out and putting it out. And thinking about, man, what are we doing here? You know, but it's legacy. It's that this content is going to live on. It'll live on past my life, you know, and that I know that these stories and that this content is helpful. And that's a big thing, too, is about the creation of the content. It's empowering people. I know so many people who are living in sober environments. They're going to meetings. They're doing all the right things, and life is pretty much whatever. And that's just not a life that you're going to want to stay sober for, you know? And, and you're right. Like, the passion behind living is something that we've been blessed to find and a reason to do this. And some people, man, they just don't have that. And how can we get that to them? And what is that? And I love it that utilizing the arts, and man, so many of us addicts are entrepreneurial, and some of us aren't, but for those of us who are, man, when I got connected with other entrepreneurs in recovery and I could talk to them about my stuff, you know, the concept of not being 100% sure where next month's revenue was coming from or how we're going to do this and how we're going to do that, and having those conversations with other people in recovery who are also entrepreneurial, it gave me this mirror back to myself that I hadn't had up until that point, you know. And then to realize that, hey, I am entrepreneurial. I'm not just going to be able to be taking a job and sitting down somewhere and turning the wheel. And that's okay. That's in my DNA. Yeah. And so I think it's great. And that's huge. And that's exactly what we're trying to do here, is empower individuals to tell their story, to create these stories. How do you tell these stories? It's important to be tied to the passion. And man, I wish I would have had your number 2 years ago, man. You probably would have saved me a lot of drama. I've heard it so many times that year five, year six, there's that plateau and that kind of like, I've done everything, I've gotten here, really, there's nothing wrong with life, but there's that spark is missing. And I love that you're acknowledging that it happens and that you've created a solution to what can we do for people in that place? Yeah.
You know, I would say the obsession to drink and use has definitely left, but the obsession to obsess has never left.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I can obsess about something good, right?
Yeah.
And build companies and help people and be good. Or I can obsess about something bad. Mm-hmm. And here's the scary thing about me, even being sober this long, Christian, is I can have 9 good things going on in my life. Healthy kids, a strong business, all that stuff. And it's the one thing that's not, then you know where my mind goes.
Right
over
there.
Here. And I will vibrate there, mm-hmm. vacillate there, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, as that energy begins to go down, number 9 goes down, number 8 goes down, I start losing what's really going on. And that's where I think what you're talking about in year 5 and 6 is what we have to discover is emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
You can't go off on the guy giving you a parking ticket. You can't call customer service of American Airlines and ream it. If the person cuts in line, hey, let them cut in line.
Yeah.
You know, it's really where the balance happens, where boys become men and girls become women is emotional mm-hmm. sobriety. And you hit it right there. I think that does happen around year five or year six, mm-hmm. you know. And then something else I discovered in year 10 and 11, Al-Anon. I began going to Al-Anon.
Yeah.
Because here's what was presented to me. Hey, Greg, you've been in this program for 10 something years. The majority of the people in your life are alcoholics and drug addicts.
Right. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And so all of a sudden I began going there and I began finding some peace. I don't go there all that often, but it's a different vibe, same mm-hmm. language, different vibe.
Yeah.
So I encourage people who are in a decade, try that as another tool.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's interesting. My sponsor and I were actually just talking about that. It's such a great tool for us. Especially, yeah, when everyone we're working with is in early recovery and you're having to deal with them. Yeah, and understanding that. It's really interesting, man. What I found with these 12 steps and the application of them, it's a means, it's a handbook, it's a practical guide to living. I truly believe it's applicable to anybody and anyone who's trying to make a change in their life. And so,
let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. If we were to take the 12 steps into every fourth grade classroom in this country,
right?
How good would this country be
right.
in about a decade?
Yeah.
You know, I'm powerless over the bully. Mm-hmm. I'm powerless over my homework.
Right.
You know, right? Yeah. You know, take any, you know, I'm powerless over my being picked last on all the sports teams.
Yeah.
And my life has become unmanageable, right? Mm-hmm. And then you just start working through it.
Yeah.
You know? What if a kid did a daily 10 step?
Right.
Yeah. You know, it would transform this country like no other thing.
Yeah. Well, we teach teach a lot of the outer world, you know, that's what is that, and that's a something, yeah. and that's a something. But we don't do a great job of doing is teaching the inner world, you know, and the thinking and the feelings and how do you deal with that? And we usually don't start addressing it until there's some external activating event or circumstances that we start going, oh, what's going on with Jimmy and why is he acting out? And so I agree 100%. I mean, we have to start teaching this internal world to people at a very young age. Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
What do you got? You got something for me. What do you got?
No. I just say that, I would like to talk a little bit about suicide.
Yeah.
A lot of our peers take themselves out.
Yeah.
Either through overdoses or jumping off bridges or whatever. But I also know people who are in sobriety and they take themselves out.
Yeah.
And I just want to tell this story about, for me, I have that thought twice a year. I do. I just do. Twice a year, hey, today's the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I just want people out there that it's okay to have that thought. It's not okay to have the action.
Right.
And I tell this story is that in 2004, I took a job in Denver. And all my California friends are like, oh, you're going to freeze your butt off out there. It's always cold and snowy out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the perception of Denver was, hey, it's going to be freezing. It's going to be cold. You're going to die out there. Well, I went out there and I lived a year out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you know this, but Denver has 300 days of sunshine.
Wow.
Okay. It has 65 days of different weather, 20 days of cloudiness, another 20 days of snow showers, another 20 days of real hard packed snow, and then 5 days of the blizzard. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I want you to equate this is that in my life, I have 300 days of sunshine.
Yeah.
I have 300 days of good days. Then I have some days that are kind of foggy, right? Then I have some days like, hey, the shit's hitting the fan, right? Yeah. There's another 20. And then I have others like, boy, today's the day I'm going to blow my stack. And then there's the 5 days that I think about killing myself, right? So very much like Denver is I have these 5 days.
Yeah.
And what I can tell you is this, and here's my secret sauce about those tough days. We don't have bad days. We have a bad 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Christian, what we do in those 2 hours will dictate if we have a bad day. So I'll give you an example. I wake up with my head on fire. If I don't go to the gym, if I don't pray and meditate, my head's still on fire, right? If I get a flat on the freeway, right? I can call it a day and get in the fetal position and go home, or I can fix the flat and go on my merry way. But what I ask people to do is use the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous in those 2 hours to get you out of the bad day.
Right.
And that's texting your sponsor, going to a meeting, pray and meditate, do breath work, go for a swim, do something in that 2 hours that gets you, that allows for that storm cloud to pass.
Right.
And so I encourage people that are struggling with recovery and sobriety to use the tools when it starts getting dark.
Yeah. And realize too that, like you said, it's a moment that, and I've had my own experience with that, you know, where I've felt that moment and the energy rise up in me. And realizing that, you know, I just made a split second decision to not do it. And it really settled in to realize, wow, that's really what it is. It's this moment of intense anger or pain. And we make that decision. And for some of us make that decision and we can't go back on it, you know, but it's a moment. It's one decision. And if we can get past that decision in that moment and that 2 hour time window, right, and seek the help and call somebody and talk about it, you know, and that's what's been powerful about you talking about it, about us having this conversation right now, is that, you know, it needs to be talked about, because what happens is people have these thoughts, they have these ideas, and they don't want to mention it. They don't want to talk about it. And so it keeps it a secret. It keeps the shame and the guilt built on it. And that's when it hides, and that's when it sneak attacks and it does those things, and we lose somebody dearly that we loved. So, yeah, man, I really want to thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing that about suicide. It's so important to have that conversation. And man, I'm hoping that I'll make it out there to Cali sometime. Come see you.
Please do.
Come body surf with you and maybe get a sound bath in there or something.
Yeah, We'll get the sound bath for you.
Nice, man. I really appreciate it. So if you want to know more, if you're in California or you just want to know more, startuprecovery.com to get in touch with Greg and what he's doing there. And you can always email us, contact@themosthighshow.com. Greg, thank you so much for your time and blessing us with your story and your hope and your strength.
Thank you very much, Christian. And give my best to your beautiful wife, Leslie. And I thank you both for giving me the opportunity to share my story.